Why do we produce the IMC Radio News?
Because the chasm isn't left to right. It's top to bottom.
To give voice to people who aren't heard.
To bust up the myth of objective journalism.
Bill O'Reilly does not have a monopoly on the truth.
To build our community and re-educate the public.
To revive the voice of organized labor.
To bring forth debate so as to animate democracy.
Because I want to agitate for revolution.
Listen to the voices of your community on IMC Radio News.
This week on IMC Radio News, the first in a series of interviews focusing on local people working to build community, and Auntie Bee's Knees brings us a weekly business update. But first, these headlines.
The International Solidarity Movement, ISM, was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize of 2004 by Canadian MP Sven Robinson. In his letter of nomination, MP Robinson states that the contribution of the ISM to advancing the cause of peace in the Middle East, to defending human rights, and to upholding international law is without parallel. Before that, Brazilian diplomat José Mauricio Bustani had been nominated for the 2003 prize for his work as former Director General, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. In April 2002, Bustani was overthrown in a conspiracy led by the U.S. Department of State because of his efforts to bring Iraq to the organization and conduct inspections in that country. This conspiracy is considered one of the proofs that the U.S. government had decided to invade Iraq long before UN Resolution 1441. The Nobel for Bustani may also correct what many Brazilians consider a historical injustice against their country. In the 103 years of the Nobel, no Brazilian has ever won the prize, although many writers, pacifists, and scientists were nominated, among them physicists Mario Schoenberg and Cesar Lattes, who made discoveries that later gave the Nobel to scientists of other countries.
The following headline was taken from the Urbana-Champaign IMC website. Recently, the graduation speaker at Rockford College in Illinois was shouted down, physically intimidated, and forced to cut short his speech by a gang of conservative audience members. The speaker, Chris Hedges, is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter from the New York Times. When he spoke out against the U.S. war on Iraq and claimed that we were an occupying force, not a liberating force, a number of audience members began booing and shouting quote-unquote patriotic slogans. Several of them jumped up on the stage, and the power to Mr. Hedges' microphone was unplugged several times, and it became impossible for him to continue. The lack of commitment conservatives have for free speech is becoming painfully clear.
Global Indie Media reports that a Dutch court has decided that a single statement given under torture is sufficient for extradition from the Netherlands. This opens the way to extradite Juanra to Spain. Juanra Rodriguez is a Catalonian activist from Barcelona, engaged in issues like globalization, squatting, and anti-fascism, as well as singer of the band KOP. In January 2002, he was arrested in Amsterdam on the grounds of claims by the Spanish state that he allegedly provided information to a unit of ETA in Barcelona. Juanra has spent over 5 months in solitary confinement in a Dutch prison so far. In April 2003, the Juanra support group has filed a complaint at the International Criminal Court in Den Haag against Spanish Prime Minister Aznar and Judge Garzon. During the process, it has become clear that the reasons the Spanish state gave for the extradition are rather thin. As an activist, Juanra is in great danger of being tortured and has little chance to get a fair trial.
The following headline was taken from the Global Indie Media site. Just 2 days after the September 11th attacks, Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Christy Todd Whitman told New York's downtown residents and workers that their air was safe. Quote, "I'm glad to reassure the people of New York that their air is safe to breathe and their water is safe to drink," unquote. Whistleblowers inside Whitman's department would later reveal that Ground Zero was one of the most toxic environmental disasters in U.S. history. Whitman's handling of the Ground Zero cleanup would turn out to be emblematic of her 28-month stewardship of the nation's environment, which saw the weakening, or worse, of the Clean Air and Clean Water Acts and the Kyoto Agreement on global warming. On Wednesday, the former New Jersey governor stepped down from her position.
Chicago Indie Media reports that on Monday, May 19th, the Evanston City Council voted 6-0 to pass a resolution which calls for the full repeal of the deceptively named USA Patriot Act and for the preservation of our civil liberties. This is the first town in Illinois to pass such a resolution. After several months of effort, and after working its way through a commission, a committee, and then the full council, on Monday evening, the city of Evanston passed a resolution opposed to the Patriot Act and the current climate of repression and intimidation in this country. The vote was 6-0, with one abstention and two aldermen not present. Evanston now joins 107 other cities and one state in the U.S. who have taken a public stand against the Patriot Act, and in defense of our constitutionally guaranteed, but often abrogated, civil liberties. See the Bill of Rights Defense Committee www.bordc.org for the full list.
That wraps up headlines. Thanks to Kevin Heinrich for gathering them and to Gia Kugan for reading them here in the studio. The IMC and WEFT are both community organizations that attempt to empower their members to tell the stories that are not otherwise heard. This week, IMC reporter Andine Gross takes advantage of that opportunity with the first in a series of pieces which focus on people working to build community.
Good to Know, a series of conversations with diverse members of the Champaign-Urbana community who work to build community. I'm speaking with Lydia Khoury. Lydia is an Arab-American clinical psychologist in private practice. She also teaches at the University of Illinois in the program on intergroup relations. The dialogue classes which she co-teaches are on such subjects as race and ethnicity, exploring white identity, men and women, and LGBT intergroup dialogues. Today, we will be speaking about a class on Arab-Jewish dialogue that Lydia co-teaches with Alan Potash, director of Hillel, the Champaign-Urbana Jewish Community Organization. Tell us about your personal background and where your parents came from.
I'm sort of a mix. My father is Palestinian, and he immigrated to the States in 62 via Lebanon. And then my mother is American-born, Lebanese, and her mother was from South Carolina. Sort of Scottish, Irish, you know, grew up on a farm for, you know, generations and generations.
What is your relationship with the Palestinian or Middle Eastern community in Champaign-Urbana?
I have no relationship with them per se. I came down here to work professionally, first do my internship in psychology, and then work in psychology, obviously. I don't know if there is a Palestinian community per se. There are Arabs here, certainly students and then community members, and there are Muslims here, and you know, Muslims come in all sorts of ethnic backgrounds, colors. But because I'm Christian, or my background is Christian, not Muslim, there are few Christian Arabs, much fewer Christian Arabs in general than there are Muslims, although the majority of Arabs in this country are Christian. Their estimates around 75%. Those were the first immigration waves.
And when you get together Arab descent students and Jewish descent students, what are some of the biggest misconceptions you think one group has about the other?
I don't know if this is a misconception per se, but there's sort of a dehumanizing and an othering of the other. All Arabs want to destroy Israel. All Jews want to see the Palestinians wiped out. For those students who feel closer to either side, it's much more intense. But on both sides, there's a kind of openness to humanizing the other, even if they don't change their minds or their positions. So we include students who are neither Arab nor Jew in our particular dialogue, and sometimes they bring a perspective that's quite, they ask the kinds of questions that those who are more entrenched ideologically don't think to ask, or almost censor themselves or have been censored.
It's interesting that you talk about the otherness of it. I was reading an article called Palestinian Dialogue, Try Again by Zaina Awad, a Canadian activist, and she talked about a zero-sum relationship whereby one side's gain is the other side's direct loss.
That's a very entrenched aspect of the ideology around the conflict. And when I say entrenched, I mean sort of psychologically entrenched. I think the perception of loss on both sides should one give an inch is pretty powerful.
And the dehumanizing piece of it is very necessary, isn't it, to maintain that ideological stance?
Absolutely. The other, it becomes part of the narrative. You know, the other is the evil one.
In doing some reading, it looked like the two sides sort of follow along this way. The Palestinian narrative might trace a history of dispossession and colonization at the hands of the Israeli government, which, of course, currently includes a great deal of violence.
Mm-hmm.
The Jewish story might be that the Holocaust and the history of persecution of Jewish people justified a Jewish homeland. Jews would argue that Arab regimes have treated Palestinians no better. Palestinians might argue that their dispossession put the Arab mistreatment into place. Does this sound familiar?
Oh, both of these narratives resonate. I mean, they don't resonate with me, but they sound familiar.
First of all, I'm sort of intrigued about how you can discuss these things without a high level of emotionalism and anger,
mm-hmm.
and how you move to the next level and not have it fall into a competition of who has historically suffered more.
I don't think you can have dialogues or conversations like these about this particular topic, especially when the discussants are either Israelis or Palestinians or Jews and Arabs, without a high level of feeling about it. For me, the task in the role of a facilitator is to work with that affect. You got to set up conditions so neither you as a facilitator nor participants are afraid of that kind of affect, because this is pretty deep stuff for most people. So how do you make room with it, work with it? How does it become an acknowledged layer of the dialogue? And if things fall into debate, you return to what hopefully you set up as the guidelines around how to dialogue, how to present multiple perspectives, how to really listen to each other, and how to say, I hear your narrative and I understand where it's coming from. It's hard to do. I think for me, one of the challenges was the more I understood, and I'm saying this somewhat monolithically, so you can challenge me or correct me or whatever, but the more I understood the facets of the Jewish narrative and the more empathy I had, the more angst-ridden I was in terms of, am I betraying the Palestinian narrative? Am I betraying my family's narrative? We have an online discussion, and of course we're all a bunch of Palestinians, American, but also I have in Amman and in the United Arab Emirates and Lebanon, so we're all over the place. An intense discussion, and of course it's, you know, it veers toward, here's another article that supports my position, you know, rather than, why are these narratives so different? What does one side need from the other? This gets so complicated because how power is defined is so different depending on your perspective. I think what you quoted from in terms of the two narratives, the Palestinians see themselves in a one-down position vis-a-vis the Israelis, and the Jews see themselves in a one-down position vis-a-vis the history of anti-Semitism that's extended for 2,000 years, and hostility from Arab nations. That's for real. I don't think the Palestinians want to see Israel wiped out, and I think Israel is there to stay, but Israel has to deal with the fact that there are all these Palestinians, and they're living in conditions.
A lot of people think dialogue is naive. A lot of people think dialogue is not going to make any difference and it's worthless and the issues are too deep and it's about power and it's about money and it's about the United States supporting Israel. I mean, I've heard these perspectives.
From my perspective, that's a long-standing question. Does dialogue lead to action? Are the two incompatible? Is dialogue naive? Is action without reflection naive? I think you can get into philosophical either-or debates about it. To me, the two don't have to be mutually exclusive, and you have to deal with issues of power and economics if you want to understand fully why there are power differentials or, you know, structural inequality in the first place. And again, people do dialogue differently, but dialogue to me does not preclude dealing with the political. to come together and let's all talk and share stories is very powerful. But why do these stories contrast so sharply? Not just how, but why do they contrast?
I asked Lydia about her own process and what it took for her to get ready to have dialogue with others.
I got to a place where I felt I was ready to be able to look at these issues. I was personally ready. Before, I was like, there's no way in hell I'm touching this with a 10-foot pole. It's too painful. I don't know enough about it myself. I'm not clear enough in terms of how I feel about things. It's too overwhelming. I mean, there were many, many years growing up as a young adult, I couldn't watch the news anytime anything came on about the conflict. And I decided I had to stop sort of trying to get away from that. I needed sort of a Jewish partner to deal with this. I mean, I tend to take an intergroup approach to dilemmas that might on the face of it face only one group. To me, it's always an intergroup problem.
What about the role of allies?
Allies are important and sometimes have a difficult role. I consider myself an ally to Jews, and I can spot anti-Semitism a mile away. So I feel like it's my responsibility to call it out.
And is that an unpopular position to take?
I think so, especially if you see it in your own group. I don't think Arabs are really willing to deal with their anti-Semitism, and I don't think Jews are really willing to deal with their anti-Arab feelings. And I mean really like gut level feelings of hate and the whole works.
Lydia Khoury is a clinical psychologist in private practice and an instructor at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign in the program on intergroup relations. She is a woman of wisdom, honesty, and openness who works to build community. Lydia Khoury is good to know.
The task is not to accept black and white versions, but always work toward truth with a capital, not a capital, truth with a small t, or truths where actually there can be some justice.
Auntie B's Knees brings us another business update focusing on the battles over globalization and privatization in Argentina, India, Germany, and Kosovo.
Hello, this is Auntie B's Knees with your business report for the week of May 26th. This week, we take a look at governments and privatization in the global economy. Néstor Kirchner was inaugurated on Sunday as Argentina's sixth president in 18 months. Kirchner is the first elected president to take power since December 2001, when five leaders ruled over the course of 2 weeks as people took to the streets in protest of economic austerity measures imposed by the government in response to demands by the International Monetary Fund, or IMF. A center-left politician from Argentina's long-dominant Peronist party, Kirchner was sworn in as Argentina's 52nd president amid promises to defend domestic jobs and industry after more than a decade of unbridled free market policies. But he also faces challenges, restoring Argentina's ties to the international investment community and guiding his country out of its worst economic decline in history. Over the last 5 years, Argentina, a country that previously enjoyed the highest living standards in Latin America, has suffered through the worst economic decline in its history. A majority of people now live below the poverty line, and unemployment rests at 22%. Kirchner, from the sparsely populated Patagonian province of Santa Cruz, won his 4-year presidential term by default after former President Carlos Menem dropped out of a runoff election. Menem decided to abandon the electoral race despite winning its initial round after opinion polls showed him losing by more than a 2-to-1 margin in a runoff contest against Kirchner. Menem was Argentina's as president from 1991 to 1999, and although he left office before the country's economy collapsed, voters hold him largely responsible for the Depression. A majority of voters in the first round of the election had voted for other candidates, including Kirchner, who rejected Menem's economic policies. Nonetheless, Kirchner comes to power after receiving only 16% of the popular vote in a preliminary election. Under Menem's leadership, Argentina had experimented with an extreme version of neoliberalism, fostering the indiscriminate opening of the country's markets to foreign capital and trade, launching the large-scale privatization of public companies and services, and implementing a currency system that fixed Argentina's peso to the U.S. dollar. Despite initial success in taming inflation and boosting economic growth, these policies made Argentina extremely vulnerable to external fluctuations in the global economy. Ripples created after the U.S. Federal Reserve started a series of interest rate hikes in 1994, followed by the Mexican peso crisis in 95 and the Asian, Russian, and Brazilian financial crises in the later years of the 90s, each sent shockwaves through the Argentine economy, which could not adjust so long as its currency was tied to the U.S. dollar and its economy was dependent on foreign investment. The result was a vicious spiral. Private capital flight by foreign investors led to increasing interest rates and a shrinking economy in Argentina, which led to more debt and even higher interest rates as investors feared currency devaluation and then debt default. The government finally did default on $95 billion worth of public debt at the end of 2000. 1 year later, the currency collapsed to one quarter its former value as banks from around the world pulled remaining investments out of the country and mass civil unrest accompanied worsening poverty. Despite the deepening crisis, the IMF continued to support Argentina's open market policies. Fund officials prolonged and worsened the depression by insisting on monetary and fiscal austerity measures at inappropriate times. All indications are that the IMF will now pressure Argentina's government to run large budget surpluses in order to make payments on its defaulted debts. This and other traditional IMF policy prescriptions could easily choke off the economy's nascent economic recovery. Since Argentina devalued its currency 1 year ago, the peso has risen more than 20% against the sinking U.S. dollar. As yet, Kirchner has been reluctant to meet with IMF officials, but Argentina's agreement with the International Money Lending Institution will expire in August, so negotiations will have to begin soon. Observers are unsure how Kirchner will respond to the pressures of the IMF and the international investment community. As a three-term governor of the sparsely populated Santa Cruz province, Kirchner's leadership skills are largely untested on the national and international stages. The new president certainly has a mandate to resist IMF demands and make economic recovery the country's first priority. But so far, his economic policy initiatives have been vague. To jumpstart the domestic economy and increase employment, Kirchner has promised a multi-billion-dollar public works program and a long-term rescheduling of the government's debt. Whether this plan will be accepted by international creditors is another question. Kirchner has already antagonized the American investment community by criticizing U.S. policies on free trade, the embargo on Cuba, and the war in Iraq. On the other hand, the devaluation of the Argentine peso, accompanied by apparent economic recovery and a booming tourism sector, has made Argentina a tempting haven for other foreign investors who are snapping up inexpensive property in the country. When and if the economy recovers, a great deal of property and industry could remain in foreign hands. Kirchner took his oath of office on Sunday before Congress in Buenos Aires. His wife, Senator Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, and their two children attended the inauguration ceremony alongside regional leaders including Cuba's Fidel Castro, Brazil's Lula da Silva, and Venezuela's Hugo Chavez. As many as 400 million workers representing both organized and unorganized labor in the public and private sectors participated in a national strike against the government of India's neoliberal economic policies last Wednesday. The strike was called by a coalition of India's most prominent trade unions, calling for a halt to the government's privatization schemes and plans to reform labor laws. The government's privatization projects aim to raise 132 billion rupees, or about $3 billion, by selling off state-run companies before March 2004. Proposed labor reforms being introduced at the same time include allowing state-run companies to dismiss workers and reducing deposit rates for pension funds. The government says that privatization is necessary to bridge India's increasing fiscal deficit and claims that labor reforms are needed to allow Indian industry to compete with countries such as China. The privatization and labor reform schemes are being promoted by the IMF and the World Bank as a way out of debt for India's government. Workers argue that the plans will lead to huge job losses and an end to job security in both the public and private sectors. The protest demands included halting the privatization of profit-making public sector businesses, cutting foreign direct investment in all service sectors, enacting comprehensive legislation to protect agricultural workers, maintaining the status quo on labor laws, and broadening social security. The strike affected banking, insurance, telecom, transportation, postal services, and mining operations across the country. Public services were particularly affected. Nationalized banks and post offices closed for the day. Work was also suspended in electricity and public health departments. Protesters organized rail and road blockades in various parts of the country while holding demonstrations and rallies. Calcutta was brought to a virtual standstill as protesters marched through the streets. The strike was described as the biggest show of discontent in recent times against the central government's economic policies. Germany's most powerful unions also staged a nationwide strike last week to protest the government's plans to trim unemployment benefits and loosen job protection. As many as 90,000 workers marched in 14 cities across the country Saturday to protest Chancellor Gerhard Schröder's proposed reforms. Agenda 2010, announced in March, is Schröder's response to a German economy on the verge of recession, with a rising budget deficit and unemployment close to 11%. As the German government's budget looks toward a 15 billion euro deficit in 2004, Schröder argues that costly social programs will have to be trimmed to ensure the long-term survival of Germany's welfare state. But there are other reasons for the dwindling reserves in Germany's federal coffers. Tax cuts introduced by Finance Minister Hans Eichels slashed government revenues from corporate taxes by 23 billion euros in 2000 to virtually nothing in 2001. Postmen, nurses, and bus drivers in Germany now pay more tax than Daimler Chrysler does on its profits. Agenda 2010 marks the most severe budget cuts to be introduced by a German government since the Second World War. Cuts to public welfare include shortening the period of payments for unemployment insurance and consolidating different forms of benefits, drastically cutting access to health insurance, transferring the costs of health care onto the shoulders of working people and the sick. Critics say the program, combined with recent tax cuts, represents a massive redistribution of wealth from the hands of working people to the profit margins of big business. But mobilizing labor against these initiatives has been slow, particularly among unions tied to the private sector. Many participants in last weekend's rallies expressed disillusionment with their unions, some of which have officially urged collaboration with the government on developing cuts to social services. And lastly, the United Nations sell-off of the Kosovan Protectorate has begun, as the UN publishes tenders for the controversial privatization of almost 500 formerly publicly owned companies in the region. Serbia, of which the Kosovan Protectorate is still legally a part, has opposed the privatizations. Kosovan trade unions have also opposed the sales. Kosovo became a UN protectorate in June of 1999 after an 11-week bombing campaign by NATO led to a Serbian withdrawal. According to the Kosovo Trust Agency, a UN body, the interim administration has introduced laws to, quote, ensure a very investor-friendly environment, including regulations on foreign investment, repatriation of capital, the purchase of real estate, and 99-year leases of land formerly used by socially owned enterprises, end quote. The UN claims that the sell-offs are vital for kickstarting Kosovo's economy, where about 2 million inhabitants depend mainly on foreign aid. But the head of Serbia's Coordinating Center for Kosovo has denounced the leases, claiming Belgrade was not consulted about their introduction. The Serbian government is particularly concerned about $1.4 billion in foreign debt it has guaranteed that is owed by the Kosovan companies. Despite being promised 20% of the privatization proceeds, unions representing workers at the companies have also opposed the sales. The Ombudsman for Kosovo, an independent arbitrator for human rights issues, expects appeals against the privatization to be filed. And that's a wrap for this week's Business Report. Signing off, this is Andy Beasneys reminding you to put your money where your mouth is and invest ethically.
That's it for IMC Radio News this week. Contributors include Andine Gross, Auntie B, and Kevin Heinrich. The coordination of the UC IMC Radio News is funded by the Funding Exchange's Paul Robeson Fund for Independent Media. If you'd like to get involved with this show, drop us a line at radio@ucimc.org or call 344-8820 extension 1. No experience is necessary. Archives of this program are available at the IMC website, www.ucimc.org. Financial contributions are also welcome. You can send those checks to the UCIMC care of Radio News at 218 West Main Street, Urbana, Illinois, 61801. Take care, have a good Memorial Day, and see you next week.